Access number 29065, Mr. Michael White, Reel 9. Now, so what happens next is really where we're at. You've arrived, you've been shown your three-man dugout, or bunker, whatever you want to call it. The other lot have gone. You've had a briefing from your commanding officer. It isn't 4 o'clock yet. I think that's, which is the time they warned you about. So what happens next? We're quite interested in this settling in phase.
Well, what I actually remember of it, we'd settle in that and we'd had a kind of brief interview with our so-called new commanding officer. Everyone was walking around very anxious sort of thing, waiting for something to happen. At that period, it was more or less quiet. But then this was the period of kind of like the end of October, I suppose perhaps beginning of November. And, of course, around about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, these mists used to come up and then it used to start getting dark. And this is when all the things that are happening started all along the different parts of the line. And so, as I remember sort of thing, we suddenly had a take post. And now when we were actually training with the guns, with all guns, as you perhaps see them on Hyde Park and, with the King's Troop Royal Artillery, the gunners all go down on one knee. And so during the training, say like in Hong Kong, the gunners used to go on one knee and the number one gun sergeant used to stand at the back with his arm in the air sort of thing and things like that. And then so when we had our first take post, and of course the Tara, because the situation was the map reference came back from the OP through by radio or telephone, and then kind of the it was passed on to me, and I did the map reference and the artillery board, and then kind of arranged it, and then the officer bellowed out to the number one gun, 0 left, 1 0 degrees, and then kind of the range sort of thing, 2 to 25 yards or whatever it was, and then kind of it would be set up, and then kind of the gunners then would be actually on one knee as the training procedure. And so, and then when the actual, it came to kind of 5 rounds gunfire, and then they fired off sort of thing, and then kind of like it was then after that, no one actually went on their knees in like the mud and the dirt in the garden pits and things like that, and that never happened again during our whole period actually in Korea. And so when as it started off as the night progressed sort of thing, kind of I remember the kind of in front of us, I think at the Royal Canadian Regiment, and kind of on the different hill bits and pieces and things like that, there were the different Canadians. There was the Van Dues, which is the French Canadians, the Royal 22nds, and then I think the Princess Pats, the Princess Petitus Canadian Light Infantry. And the immediate hill in front of us was numbered Hill 166, which over the months to come sort of thing, or the period there, we actually pounded it with our mortars. And that night, the French Canadian Van Dues, they actually went on a patrol to Hill 166, and as I remember, I think they actually had 2 killed. And then we actually fired on support of these and things like that. And I remember kind of we actually hit an ammunition dump, when all the flares and all the bangs and crashes went up and things like that. And then that was more or less basically, as I remember, through the night. So as gunners, we was actually on call full 24 hours a day and night, and then the full 7 days. I mean, there was no leeway. There was no sleeping during the day and that.
Now,
and then during the night time, the people had to go on guard and in the command.
Hang on, you're running ahead. Now, what about, did you get, was there much artillery? There was an exchange of artillery fire after 4 o'clock. Any shells landing near you or in the area near you? I mean, was there much coming the other way?
Well, lots of the shell fire actually was actually aimed at the, infantry. Or over the top of us. We got the 25 guns and all that all behind us, all these American guns and things like that, all went back in stages. And, of course, with mortars, we were on close support of the infantry.
They weren't, the Chinese or North Koreans weren't firing at you?
Oh, the guns, especially mortars, because being a hilly country, Korea is very similar to, say, like the hilly part of North Wales or Scotland, or in the central part of Korea. I mean, it can be quite mountainous. And so all the hills, all the fighting really was kind of holding the hills, and the main thing really was to hold the highest hill in that part, because if you lost the highest hill, you had to kind of withdraw.
But I understand that, but what I'm trying to discern is whether any you were under artillery or mortar fire yourselves.
During that early period sort of thing, I can't remember kind of our actual position being shelled at that period. The first
it was just the back. There was firing, but it wasn't anywhere near you. It was
firing right across the line.
Now,
Because what was actually happening, the Chinese, or of course during the night, there were either patrols out all in no man's land where there were problems there, or kind of like the one side of the other was actually attacking a hill to try and do kind of claim a new hill.
Now, what about the airstrikes? Because apparently there are a load of airstrikes on your second day in. We don't know the exact date. They can look it up.
Yeah.
I think it's around about the 8th, 9th of November, but that I may be wrong as well. Yeah.
Well, all through my period of career, there were airstrikes more or less every other day, or every day, or every other day. And, of course, the very first one I always remember, going top of the kind of the top of the hill sort of thing. This was in the daytime, and I remember watching these the spotter plane used to come over, and it was quite often American, and like one of these old a Harvard type. I think they called them Texan, I think the Americans called them, but I think the Brits used to call them Harvards. They're very noisy, they were, and they used to kind of fly over and zip it up and down the hills and things like that, looking for kind of targets, perhaps where the enemy's guns were and that. And then all of a sudden, these planes, a lot of them around our area used to come from the aircraft carriers, because there were lots of aircraft carriers dotted all around the peninsula of Korea. And there was the British carriers and the Americans, and I think there was Australia and that. And so most of the actual planes used to come over us were either from the Brit carriers or the Aussies. And so when they had their kind of target, you'd see about four of these planes, mostly turboprop in those early days. And they'd be in a group, and then all of a sudden they'd get their target, and then suddenly they'd peel off and they'd go down like the Stukas of World War II. And you could see the bomb drop, then all of a sudden there'd be this explosion and what have you, then they'd all peel off and dinner. And then when they'd circle round again, and then when perhaps the bombs had actually finished, they'd come back with their machine guns, and you could see all the flicking of the machine guns from the wing sort of thing, and then when it was expired, they'd be off. But when the American jets used to come over, I mean, they were perhaps more noisy, more impressive and things like that, but they never used to go in such a steep dive as the turboprop ones from the carriers. And of course the Americans also used to have rockets on their planes as well, and all of a sudden you'd see the plane give like a slight shudder, and then all of a sudden you'd see these rockets leap ahead and things like that. And then of course also as well was used a lot was the napalm bombs. I mean, I know later on in the Falklands War they classed it as horrific when they found napalm on the Stanley backs, but in Korea it was napalm everywhere, and you used to see these kind of like canisters, and they used to drop from the planes, and all of a sudden it used to seem though it bounced, you know, either once or twice, and all of a sudden there was this big flash, and then this huge plume of smoke went up and went up, and it used to be marvellous to watch sort of thing as a spectator.
Now you were doing a lot of digging early on, not you perhaps personally, but as a
unit. Yes, everyone.
Tell us about the digging. What were you digging to do?
Yeah, everyone in the early days, because we more or less moved into this position, which hadn't been properly completed. So, I mean, we actually started off with a command post, and so we actually dug this huge, great big hole, and we had to put a roof over the top. We kind of pine trunks and things like that, and then over the top we'd go in kind of all sandbags and that. But this was kind of like one of the larger holes because it was a command post, and we also had a small section where the command post officer actually slept. He had a little tiny bunk piece which was kind of partitioned off, I think, with some sort of a canvas thing. But in the command post itself, there was used to be the wireless set of 19 set, which is one of the bigger ones, and then there used to be about a couple of telephones, and then there used to be the artillery board, and then they used to, at night time, we used to have a lantern or a homemade lamp and things like that. But the actual digging, because we was on kind of like a hillside, it was all rocks and things like that. So after we'd actually finished this was the Taurus and the Signalers. They dug the command post, and then the gunners themselves, they then dug this big kind of pit type thing, and then they built it up with sandbags, and where the mortar could actually traverse a complete 360 degrees, because really kind of where we were actually situated, the line wasn't a straight line, it was a zigzag all over. So really you could be fine more or less kind of at the equivalent of say like 3 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 9 o'clock, things like that. And if the actual enemy actually attacked and you got through, you could be fine behind you. So the gun position or the gun pit had to be around, more or less a round circle, which where the mortar could traverse 360 degrees, and it was built up with sandbags. And then on one side they used to keep like an opening where they used to have they used to keep the mortar bombs in, which was ready more or less to plop down the mortar. Then after the command post had been completed and the gun pits were completed, then the whole lot of us all had to kind of do our own sleeping quarters. Now, as I said, it was actually on a hillside, and the hole that we actually took over was about 4 feet or 4 or 5 feet high one side and about a couple of feet at the bottom. And so we had to kind of dig down a bit low, as I remember. And then we went out. We chopped down this big pine tree. Always remember, it was very heavy, and so we used that. It went across the top of our hole as such, and then kind of we got the branches and we put those crossways, and then over the top of that we got these empty sandbags. We had to fill them up with the earth which we dug out of the hole. We put them all across there, and when we thought it was kind of solid enough, and then there was this old tarpaulin sort of thing with the one with the hole in, as I mentioned, that went over the top when kind of like as the weather chopped and changed, it kind of be raining, and it would stop the rain as such filtering through. So that was the next one there.
So now what about we might as well carry on with the dugout, because keep on going with the improvements, because you were there a while and you do more. We might as well deal with it all together. So how else did you improve the I mean, the heating is but take me through the rest of the improvements to the dugout.
Well, when we first got there, We just slept on the floor. We just put either a poncho, which is a plastic thing on the bottom, and then kind of the sleeping bags and things on top. So you slept on the floor. And it was only later when we was actually digging, and I came across one of these American kind of camp beds, which is kind of like the folding wooden camp bed with a canvas thing. And I suppose it had perhaps been some position when the fight had been moving forward and backwards and things like that, and I suppose perhaps got covered over, perhaps with shelter or what have you. So then I was the only one at that time that used to have a camp bed, apart from the officer that was. And so we just continued it on. And then, of course, also within our grouping, we had a group of Korean labourers. Now, these labourers as such, these were kind of theoretically paid by the Korean government, some pittance, but they were more happy to be Korean labourers rather than being conscripted into the Korean army, where they're more likely to be killed off by now. And so they used to kind of do anything there. So what happened then, they then dug, the Korean labourers dug their own accommodation holes and things like that, and then afterwards they then dug a hole for the rubbish dump, so all the rubbish went in, because you can't have rubbish everywhere and that. So and then also the toilet, and I remember the first toilet we had, it was just a hole in the ground sort of thing, and they built up these two posts with a bar across, just like a goal post when you play football and things like that. So it was long, and theoretically they dug this quite hole, big hole, and then kind of anyone could actually squat on this actually thing. But when it started getting cold in the winter, all the fuss used to go along this thing, so people were very reluctant to go to the loo actually in the night period. They waited till the sun got up, when the soil of the ground started unfreezing a bit, because at times in the bitter winter parts sort of thing, the ground used to freeze about 2 or 3 inches, and used to break all these pick handles and things like that used to break, because you couldn't break through them. But occasionally when we're also digging, you come across some huge great big rock, and our new commanding officer, who was kind of an old soldier of World War II sort of thing, he had all this gun cotton, which is kind of like, I'd never seen it before, it's kind of like a white kind of plastic type thing with kind of hole, and he used to put this this thing in the top sort of thing, and then he'd kind of light it, and everyone would move back sort of thing. There'd be a big bang and pieces of rock flowing everywhere, and this used to help get these rocks out.
Now, what about heating the dugout?
Heating. Now, in the early days, because it was kind of getting cold, so in the dugout itself, what we did then, because we was all completely new, and where the information came from, I've got no idea at all. So we started off, we had this kind of this big round kind of, I think it was an old oil drum, you know, what would it be, 50, wouldn't it, wouldn't be 50, it would be so many litres
anyway.
Five,
it says here.
It was a big oil can. So what we had, because we had no real tools as such, it was all make, do and mend. So all we really had, we had the old army jackknife with kind of like a tin opener and a big spike on it. And also there was the old signaller's ply. So we made a round hole in the top. And from the cookhouse thing, we collected all these tins, and we cut the tops and the bottoms out, and we pushed one inside the other till we got like a big tube, and we pushed that in the hole of the hole, and we made a hole in the roof of our dugout. And then what I remember then, we used to kind of collect firewood in those days, but it used to be quite efficient, but the problem was collecting firewood, because all the other time during the day we was either digging, we was either on taking posts and things like that. So in the end they actually moved over to petrol, and so we acquired one of these I think it was a 25-pound metal case and things like that. Once again we managed to cut a round hole in it, and I think we took part of the top off. And so then we then kind of fitted kind of our chimney through the roof again, once again. And so we then collected petrol. We got a 5-gallon jerry can down the bottom. We used to have a big 40-gallon drums of petrol and stuff down there, so we could always fill it up. We used to have to, with a siphon, like a tube in there, siphon it out. And so we had a... We used to kind of, because we got no real tubing as such, so we acquired this bits and pieces of tubing. We used to have to cut it up, and we used to have this old signaller's aerial, which is like a metal tube sort of thing, and we used to stick one piece in the other to make, so we got a complete length. And so we had the upside down jerry can in the top of the roof, and this hanging down, and that actually filtered down, and then in the on the end of the actual the tubing at the bottom, before it dripped into the box itself sort of thing, we'd have got some like a wing nut, which we'd quad off something like that, where the actual idea, as you screw it in, it just squeezed the tube up to stop it going in. And so actually in the actual the fire itself, we used to put some soil in that, and then you kind of just the petrol dripped down, you know, depending how much you wanted, and then you put you lit it, a match and things like that. And sometimes that actual stove used to glow quite red, it was quite hot. And we also used it as well for when we used to put our C7, you know, tins of pork and beans on top, you know, just pierce the end and put it on top, heat it on there. So
it sounds incredibly dangerous.
It's very dangerous, because as I remember, right in the early stages when we were still supporting the Canadians, I think they had a big fire in one of the forward positions sort of thing, and I think two of their dugout went up in flames, which a lot of them actually did. And I think I remember them carrying these two Canadians out on this like stretchers, and of course it's all bumpy going up and down this kind of this hilly terrain and things like that, and I think they actually died and things like that. And so not so long after that, we had these orders from afar to say that they ban in petrol, because there were so many of these fires went up, dugouts were being lost, and I suppose people were being burned. And so they banned petrol in favour of diesel. And so we transferred over to diesel, and it was still quite efficient and things like that. But when you used to fill it up with a siphoning tube, you know, from the 40-gallon drum, you used to suck it, and you always used to have that awful diesel taste in your mouth and things like that.
Was that safer?
Well, I think diesel is supposed to be more safer than petrol.
What about fumes? Because people, I mean, it's not just burning to death. You can actually
No, I cannot remember any fumes, because entrance to the dugout was just kind of like a hole sort of thing, and we used to have a cover hanging down, you know, to keep the light in as such. But as far as lighting in the dugouts, that all we had, we was issued with candles, so many candles per week. These are the ordinary white candles. And so kind of... with the ideas that we used to have a free issue of cigarettes in these round 50 tins. I didn't smoke sort of thing like that, so it didn't bother me. But with these tins, what we used to do, we used to kind of, with a jackknife, we punched a hole in the top, and then I suppose from the ambulance box or wherever it was, things like that, we were medical box, we used to get this cotton wool, and we used to kind of twiddle it in the fingers and push it down that like a wick. So then this, in the bottom of the cigarette tin, we used to put something like paraffin in the bottom, then we used to light the wick and things like that, and it used to do, but we used to get this, it was a reasonable light, but you got this paraffin-y, smelly fumes and things like that, but that was actually in the dugout. But we was never in the dugout long enough really to, apart from when you actually slept, to really suffer from it, and of course by that time the light had gone out.
Now, I believe it was very wet in the early days. Can you talk, I mean, before it started to freeze, it was wet. Tell me about the wet part. Yeah, what was living conditions
like? In November, it used to kind of rain a lot sort of thing and things like that, and we was kind of happy with our tarpaulin over the top. But all the, because there were no roads as such, it was all just cart tracks and that, and so all these cart tracks with all these... With all these vehicles coming up either with water or bringing ammunition, because all these muddy tracks came up and things like that, and so that it caused lots of problems. And then when it come really bad, we used to have a 1500 weight water truck, which was only it was not a 4x4, it was driven by the wheels at the back, and of course with these conditions sometimes it just couldn't get up there. So they used to have a 3-tonner lorry, a Bedford 3-tonner, which was 4x4 and in four-wheel drive, and then it used to tow one of these water containers behind, and sometimes when that couldn't get up there, we used to send a jeep up there with these jerry cans, and they used to fill up with the water from there.
And what about, did you have any problem with sort of like the dugouts flooding, you know, just general flooding of your area? I mean, you've got holes in the ground that tend to fill up.
Well, in those days, it wasn't so bad, because I think most people had got a proper roof over the top. And of course, it was sandbagged all round, and so we never had any problems as I remember in those early days.
Now, what about... So what were your duties during the early days? We'll talk about a typical day when we get you established, but what about your duties?
Well, my duty was purely as the tarer. I was the chief tarer. So you could be kind of digging holes in the ground, and all of a sudden someone, there'd be people actually in the command post would be on the radio set sort of thing, or the telephones, and all of a sudden someone would yell out, take post. Balling out, so everyone had to drop whatever they were doing and rush to whatever they were, either in the command post or to the gun pits or to the what have you. So I was a tarer, and so I was then the target map reference would come over the radio, and I'd plot it, and then we'd move on. And sometimes we'd be two or three times going forward and backwards, especially at night time. Sometimes some of the targets would be all through the night or most of the night.
Now, but you had one special job that I'm looking for. That you set up a centre plotting system, which is basically recording the defensive.
Oh yeah, in those early days, because each time you actually had a map reference, it was had to plot individually. So it was decided kind of at night time, when all these patrols used to go out, there were certain parts of the inlets of the hills and the valleys and bits and pieces, like where the Chinese used to patrol, and places where they would actually come when they would attack. So all these positions, they were all pre-plotted, and I plotted each one, and we ranged each one with a single mortar. So we got those on top, and when I actually got when we was actually on target, I just put it into a reference book sort of thing, and with the map reference and the obo tear, which is the bearing from the OP to the target, and so we put those in, and we recorded them as what was it, something 1, 2, 3, 4, things like that. So in say like the night time, when perhaps the middle of the night, when perhaps the Chinese were coming through this this valley or coming up this pathway or wherever it was and things like that, all the OP officer would command was kind of the number of the reference of this number, say a thing like that, and then kind of that thing would go straight to the guns, which was made it much quicker, more efficient. But it took me right through the most of the day, and I think right up to about midnight before I actually completed the whole lot of all these pre targets.
Now, there's one incident where you were late on a tape post.
Oh yeah,
that seems to be quite an
amusing. Yeah. Now, as I said, that kind of like we all through the day, we was either on targets, we was digging, we was doing other kind of what I call physical operations, you know. And so that when it actually came to after kind of so many days or even weeks, people became very, very tired and that. And so there was one evening kind of when I think the Chinese were, because by that time then the Canadians had been relieved and the Queensland Scottish borders had kind of come back sort of thing on the hill on just on the top of us. And anyway, so they had this kind of tape post sort of thing, and the Chinese, they said that there was breaking through the forward positions of the King's Own Scottish borders, who were just in front of us. And so that when it kind of yelled out kind of tape post, I suppose because I was perhaps this tiredness, like many others, I was in this kind of this deep sleep, and kind of went in, someone kind of shook me sort of thing and said, as a tape post, they're broken through and that. So I remember kind of like I remember getting up in my sleeping bag, and of course at that time I was able to kind of take my trousers off at that position, and so I believe I couldn't find my trousers, and kind of I was actually late getting into the command post, and anyway he more or less decided to put me on a charge, and you know, because I was late, and because he was having problems plotting the target, and of course within the battery there used to be this thing about the one who plotted the target first and reported back to battery headquarters, they used to arrange the target first. It was like a little bit of a competition sort of thing, and we were nearly always first, and of course he was late getting there and he was most upset, and so he decided to put me on a charge. And then of course we was firing through most of the night sort of thing, and then kind of like the early hours in the morning sort of thing, when we actually stood down again, he rescinded his charge order sort of thing and things like that. And of course, I mean, I suppose he realised kind of like there was only two of us tirers, and he actually really needed us.
How bad was your tiredness? I mean, did it affect you?
Oh, it was very, very tired, yeah. And I think there was another occasion as well when I actually, when it came through, and I actually, when he shook me sort of thing, and I, when they said they were breaking through sort of thing, of course it was in the early days, and of course I'd had no experience really of warfare, so, and you know, this fear, and I remember sitting up in my sleeping bag, and I remember, because I had a rifle at that time, I remember kind of putting one up the spout and safety catch on, and I remember pulling the blankets right over the top of my head sort of thing like that, you know, hoping it was all going to go away sort of thing, but you know, within a second your mind clicks into thing, and I was back again, you know, back in the command post doing the targets.